Welcome to Martial Wisdom. Here you can listen to conversations on all kinds of topics related to martial arts. In today's podcast, Sensei Joe Tambu is joining me for a discussion on the future of Yoshinkan Aikido. If you'd like to support the show or just get more content, I encourage you to take a look at the Spirit Aikido online program. We're almost at 400 videos now in the program, with a lot of interesting content. I'm currently sharing some material which crosses over some content from the standing grappling world, like catch wrestling, to allow good controls and easy entries into control positions. My profound thanks to those who have subscribed to the program and those who have contributed to the PayPal tip jar. I hope you enjoy this episode. Now, on with the discussion.
All right, welcome back to Modern Aikido's podcast. I'm thrilled today to have my friend Joe Tambu joining us from Australia. So we had to kind of coordinate some time zone differences, but I'm thrilled to have him on. Welcome, Joe. I'm glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me again, Tristan. It's always a pleasure. Always an honor.
That's wonderful. The reason I reached out to Sensei was he did a really great interview. It's the first of the three series discussing kind of the future of Yoshinkan, the style of Aikido, as well as the organization. And it was a wonderful interview. I had five different people on. Unfortunately, I didn't recognize the other four by name, but I'm not a Yoshinkan guy. I'm not into that community, but everybody had some wonderful points that I kind of wanted to bring up and ask about from an outsider's perspective, because the conversation seemed to be kind of an internal, what does the Yoshinkan community, how are they going to take on going into the future and evolving the Yoshinkan Aikido brand and the organization, which seems to be splintering up. Kind of that question of about the future. And this matches some of the podcasts I've done recently about the future of Aikido in general, the future of martial arts even in general, which we just did a podcast that I put up yesterday about. So one of the things I just wanted to mention it as we get started, that you mentioned kind of halfway through the podcast, but I really liked it, just about the transparency that a lot of organizations are going through, some of these growth, or I should say challenges of splintering up, or having some doubts or concerns about where they're going into the future. And they don't want to share it with anybody. They don't want to let anybody else outside the organization or outside the community know, because it might come across as being a point of shame or something that they don't like. Whereas you took on the total transparency. Let's discuss this in the open and see what ideas we can have. And that's, I wanted to have this discussion with you, because just to share A, my appreciation of it, but B, ideas can come from everywhere, and we can all help each other by sharing the ideas that we have. And I thought by watching your interview, there were concerns and perspectives that I think are valuable for other organizations and dojos that are going through similar issues, that they might get some good perspectives from it. So I thank you for that. I thank you for the approach of transparency. It shows me I have greater trust in anybody that endorses transparency over opaqueness, for what that's worth.
If I may jump in here.
Sure. Yeah.
So what's happened in the Yoshinkan world is somehow or other happened time and time and again through martial arts.
It does.
But because this structural hierarchical system, people don't want to be seen to speak out of place. Mm-hmm. And also being the Japanese way, you don't air your dirty laundry. Mm-hmm. And with this series, I mean, I in the past have accused the Yoshinkan hierarchy of all kinds of things. But with this, we were just talking about the future openly. We didn't want to bag anyone. We didn't want to say bad things about anyone, unless there was a lesson in there.
Sure. And you did. The whole discussion was very nourishing, but it was not like a dirty laundry airing or anything like that.
And to be honest, we're only human, so it's quite hard not to be biased and come across evenly. And mm-hmm. I think all my guests did a really good job, a brilliant job.
Absolutely. I would recommend anybody go listen to it. It was fantastic.
If martial arts is a microcosm of society, then we all have things that we can take away from generational change, splintering, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
someone once said to me, when a big tree falls, there's growth from its seedlings out there. Mm-hmm. They don't fall in a straight line. They go all over the place. And there's some growth from the seedlings. There's also some, where you live off the old trunk. And you start from the old trunk, yeah? So there's no good or bad. And some groups are feeding off the carcass of the old trunk. Others have gone off and the seeds have been spread. And you know, it's natural. Both are natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
One sounds a little better. The other one didn't sound so good.
But, well, I suppose you could also look at it like within the seasons. You know, you have the spring, which is new growth. You have the summer where that new growth becomes a robust life. Then you have the fall and the winter where that life dies off and it goes dormant only to feed the next generation after the winter, and then the next spring comes.
And we also talk about shuhari, as in learning and, studying martial arts. It's also a part of life. Mm. You know, we start our dojos. We build our dojos in the second stage, and at the third stage we become our own people. Mm-hmm. Our dojos after 40 years, when all my teachers are dead, or sorry, 50 years when all my teachers have passed on, I'm not beholden to an organization if they don't share the same values.
That's true.
I've always been beholden to my teachers, but if they're no longer there, then an organization that has no rapport with me, we have nothing in common, why stay there just for the name?
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Speaking of the name, one of the things questions that you asked within your podcast that I think outside the Yoshinkan organization could, at least I could use a definition on, is Yoshin, the word Yoshin. You said, you know, to us, what does it represent? But from an outsider's view, what is the definition of the term Yoshin?
Okay, so historically, first, it was the name that Shoda Gozo Kancho's father had for his home dojo. Call it the Yoshinkan. And Yo means to build or lift, and Shin, your spirit.
Okay.
And Kan, obviously, the house. But it was, sure. So when you think about it, like, you know, if you stay true to the name, it's about building yourself as a human being. It's about becoming a better person and growing.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, and the technique was central to you growing. The Yoshinkan was very right-wing, very militaristic. It's the only style of the Yoshinkan Aikido that says os, like Kyokushin and stuff like that. And a lot of this had to do with building your spirit. And in the Yoshinkan system, it wasn't the fact that we've got basic movements, basic techniques, but it's the discipline to adhere to that.
Okay.
And that discipline made you a better person. There's different ways to become a better person. Other Aikido schools. Many ways. The Yoshinkan way is like discipline yourself, submit to the dojo, submit to the hierarchy, learn, and become a better person.
Okay. Yeah, and that actually gets to my next question, which was describing what defines Yoshinkan, the approach. And I like that was pretty clear how you described it. And it seems to come from a time where a militaristic discipline-based approach was a very necessary thing and very present in that time in Japan, or, you know, it still was a holdover to the Japanese warrior type culture. Would you say that's true?
I don't know. If you read about Japanese history, it was kind of rewritten during the Meiji era. You know, they brought about this story of swashbuckling samurai and all that to instill a sense of what they call Yamato Damashi, the Japanese spirit. It's like in America, living off the fantasy of the cowboys and gunslingers. A lot of that was just stories, but it imbued you with a sense of history, a sense of heroism, values, and the Japanese did that. So how true that is, I don't know. But the Yoshinkan, a lot of the reason the Yoshinkan is the way it is or was because the university that Shiota Gozo went to.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a university called Takushoku University, and it was very right-wing. I don't know how academically orientated it was, but it produced some top martial artists, including Kimura, the one who fought Helio Gracie, mm-hmm. For a time, Masoyama.
Mm-hmm.
And it produced all these top martial artists, and it was very competitive. Mm. So that's where the OS came in.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my study of Shiota, which you know a ton about, more about him than I do, he always appeared to me to be a no-nonsense type of guy. Like he, especially even from a physical standpoint, one of the first things I remember hearing about him was he would go out and he wanted to test his Aikido, his martial art. So he would go essentially kind of pick fights or put himself into a place where fights would happen so that he could see and learn what his martial art would do, not in a dojo setting, but in a real life setting. And when I saw footage of him as he was older, you know, middle-aged and older, not a young man, you could see there was a crispness and a focus to his martial art that very few martial artists have.
So I think, so someone once said that Shiota Gozo was a very nice man, lovely old man, fantastic, mm-hmm. etc. None of the Uchideshi would ever say that. he was a different person to different people. My own personal experience that will highlight this. I'm training with the riot police in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and the old man comes onto the mat, and in some dojos everyone stops, bows to the teacher, and the Yoshinkan, you keep practicing because that's more important than the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So he came around, he looked around, and then he called over one of the instructors, pointed at a pair training. He says, "That's not what I want. That's not what I'm teaching. This is rubbish. What are you teaching?" etc. He just barked at them, left the mat, and the teacher just started laying into the police officer, like full mm-hmm. on. "That's not what I taught you." You know, was so mm-hmm. strict.
Sure.
In the evening, that same old man comes onto the mat and walks around to people and says, "How's your wife? How's your family?" You know, and chats with people as he walks around. Because mm-hmm. in the evening, they were the general students. During the day, sure. it was the special students.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a different person. Same teacher, same dojo, different person.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. As you told that story, it also brought up the image to me of the actor and former Marine who played the drill sergeant in what was the movie, Full Metal Jacket, how he could be a screaming tyrant, you know, as a drill sergeant, but he yep. also, people that had met him in person said this is the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. You'd love to sit down and have dinner with him, love to have a beer with him, good humor, but he had a switch he turned on when it was, "I need to be a professional now because I'm training soldiers," versus now I'm being a grandfather or I'm being a neighbor, what have you. So that's kind of what I relate to, is having those different sides of your personality of what role am I filling at this moment.
And you can have that in big dojos where you have the young bucks, you have the family oriented people. Mm-hmm. In smaller dojos you can't, the feel is kind of the same with everyone. But mm-hmm. a big dojo like what the Yoshinkan used to be, there were a lot of different types of classes, mm-hmm. lots of different classes of students.
Sure.
And everyone was treated differently. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Aikido is the art of love. I never felt the love from my teachers.
Mm. Yeah, and that's, there are, to my mind, there are many different schools of thought when it comes to how to teach effectively. And, I've talked with instructors in depth about, one says, "I like the drill sergeant approach." The other one says, "I hate the drill sergeant approach. I prefer the coaching type approach." I think a valid argument to make that certain students warm up to one method of teaching better than others. And if you use the wrong one with the student, then you're not going to teach them as effectively or coach them as effectively. I had a student of mine that wanted to be, had me be a drill sergeant to them. She's like, "I want you to tell me everything I'm doing wrong. I mean, every single thing." And I had to shift a little bit to be more like what an effective teacher that she needed was going to be. I don't think there's one dominant approach that you can say works for everybody best.
That's the mark of a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's one who can not let the student decide, but decide for the student what they need.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, you have to know the student better than they know themselves.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Going back, what would you say is the most important thing in martial arts?
Ooh, that's a lot. That answer would be different for every single person because of what it is they're seeking.
Okay. And for you?
For me, it would be self-growth, really.
Mm.
It's me honing my character, my body, my abilities. And that includes not just from a martial standpoint, but from a teacher and a coach standpoint, helping other people. I found that, you know, long ago I was, as a competitor, I really wanted to perform better myself, but I found much better satisfaction when I grew to the point where I was mentoring others and got to share in their growth. Like I felt like that was what I was truly doing that would better others, but better the world by bettering others, not just becoming better myself.
So you just described Yoshin better than I did.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
That's what it is. It's about, but going back one step, like what you said is what Yoshin is, to become a better person and to help those around you. Right?
Sure.
I was taught that the biggest goal in martial arts was to suppress the ego.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I've heard that one too.
Yeah. And to suppress the ego, you don't pay compliments.
Hmm.
You tell someone that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And then one day you don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say that's good, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's stroking the ego, that's fanning the ego. This is the old school thinking. That's why all the old school teachers never paid you a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Never. And you either live with it or you just say, this is too hard and leave.
Right.
But they never paid you a compliment. They were just the best compliment, or the only compliment I ever got from Shota Gozo was he watched me and went, Yosh, and walked away.
Mm, okay.
And, you know, and that for me was big because he hardly ever said that.
Right.
But if your teacher says, oh, great, 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 all the time, then, you know. But I said to a group of students the other day, they were training for a demonstration. I said, if you want to know how good you are, I'll tell you everything you're doing right.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to be better, I'll tell you what you're doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So which is it you want? The second, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
The
first
That's one's absolutely true.
The first one's just you, I mean, fanning their egos
mm-hmm.
and saying you're good, etc. Some people need that, but in a class of an hour, you don't have that luxury.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and getting to the point where you talked about a coach or an instructor knowing their student better than they know himself, I got into really good discussion not that long ago. One of the best coaches I've ever met, he had a student that was, his mind was all the way on the opposite side. All he wanted to know was what he was doing wrong. And he, after every practice and training session, he'd be beating himself up. I screwed this up. I screwed that up. I can't do this right. I can't do that right. And what this coach said is he had to balance his student's mind a little better and say, you know what, you're focusing too much on the negative. And it's fine for you to try to audit yourself and objectively look at the mistakes you're making. But he said, I'm going to demand everything, one thing from you every time we train and every time you're on, every time you practice. And that is, you have to tell me three things you did right, just to get him to balance and not be so hard on himself that he was now kind of making himself into a mental case, you know, or head case. And I think that's the balancing the ego going the opposite way, as opposed to somebody who thinks everything they do is great. You know, they're rocking it. They don't make any mistakes. They're bothered by somebody pointing out errors. You can go too far the other direction too and be almost mentally unstable because you're so obsessive about your mistakes. And I think a good coach will spot, are you off out of equilibrium? Are you too far one way, too far the other way, and adjust as needed for, you know, don't get too ahead of yourself. And this mentor within this discussion described when he would have students that would go and compete, because they would always spar and whatnot with higher level people. What he found was, if he, being more skilled than they were, if he just absolutely works them and does goes 100% and does not let them succeed, when they get ready to compete, they're doubting themselves. Their self-confidence is low. They'll go, you know, I just got my butt kicked here, you know, for a week, and I couldn't do anything. When I go into a competition, their mind is not ready to excel. So he has to sort of control the influence of letting them feel that they're successful enough to build their confidence, because the confidence is more important than the technical proficiency. They can be technically precise and doubt themselves, and they will fail when it comes time to perform. And so he found, and I thought this was brilliant, the level of confidence has to match the level of skill. Those can't be out of balance. And nor can you be too overconfident and underskilled, or the other way around. I thought that was an interesting perspective from an instructor standpoint.
Someone once told me confidence was 80% of your technique.
No, I think that's probably right.
Not overconfidence, but confidence. Mm-hmm. And if you're confident, you're more relaxed. Relaxed, your technique's better. Your technique's better, your confidence improves. So I think you're totally right. Some teachers, and this was probably a problem with the Yoshinkan, problem with me, in that we're hard. We're very hard. And we tend to sometimes treat everyone the same. Sometimes we don't. But we have people who are really good come out and they have no confidence.
Right.
Like, I've seen people come out the Yoshinkan really good and lack confidence. I've seen people come out of Aikikai, sorry for that, generic, you know, totally rubbish, but full of confidence in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the balance has to be there somewhere.
Yeah, I think it does. And this is not even organization specific or art specific. This is across the board for anything, not even martial arts. This is, somebody can be overconfident as a airline pilot and, you know, get their plane in trouble because they can't back up what they think they know how to do. You know, one of the things I actually wanted to talk about was in terms of the, you mentioned it early in your conversation, in the podcast, about the Yoshinkan kind of breaking up. And I see this happening with so many organizations, whether they're Aikido or not, a lot of martial arts, and they seem to be parting out in terms of, usually it seems to be, personality conflicts and then ideologies kind of clashing of different values of what one person wants their art to be and their students and then another person. But there's one thing that happened recently that I think is really profound, and that is when Mori Shihan decided to change separate from Yoshinkan and rename his organization as Aiki Jiu-Jitsu rather than Aikido. And I'd like to get your perspective on that. I'd love to chat with him about it, to get like from the horse's mouth, but I don't have a contact for him directly to discuss it. But, you know, obviously I don't want you to speak for him, but your perspective, because you talked about the splitting of the organization.
Let me just clarify something there. He changed the name and then left.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Left and changed the name. Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't know the exact details, but what struck me was the change of the name.
I'll relate some of the conversations I had with him. Mm-hmm. So when he changed the name, I rang him. We go back a long way. Mm-hmm. I rang him and I said, what's happening? And he said, you know, he wanted to move away from the image that Aikido has today.
Right. And I totally understand that perspective.
Yeah. And even in the Yoshinkan system, there's teachers putting out rubbish and, you know, throwing someone this way and the uke is falling in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Throwing with your weight back like this. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, things were really getting out of control. So he wanted to take it back to what he believed. Mm. And to do that, he needed to change the branding.
Mm. Okay.
And then when he did that, the Yoshinkan hierarchy didn't like it. and said, you've changed the name, so you're no longer Neo Shinkan. See you later.
Okay.
That's why I said that was the important distinction. He changed the name first, then he...
Sure.
Then that happened.
And that's something that's actually bothered me for some time, and it still bothers me to a certain extent. And I question, is the name Aikido gotten so... I don't know what a good word would be, toxic, or has created such a poor image that keeping that name is an external problem. Like there's so much bad baggage that goes with it. Is it better to leave that name behind and just go to something that doesn't have the same type of bad image? And I still don't have an answer to that question. I don't know if there is a correct answer, but it seems like he found that answer for him.
There's a couple of things here. One, Aikido and its issues are cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in Malaysia, you know, training Aikido, I was told that Aikido is rubbish, was shit, and all my friends were doing Kung Fu and Karate, and they would say, you know, you couldn't do anything. And they were right. I couldn't do anything against them. Mm-hmm. And then I came out here and to Australia, and I was told Aikido doesn't work, etc., etc. And in the 90s, the Steven Seagal phenomenon hit off, and Aikido went to the top of its cycle, and now it's going down again.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to... Does Aikido work in the MMA situation? No. Does Aikido work if someone pulls a knife on you? No, because we don't follow the principles of Aikido. If someone pulls a knife, we stand still. Why are we standing still?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. You know, I'd be moving. I'd be putting something between you and me. I'd be moving. So people say, let's test your Aikido, and people stand there. Okay, let's go. I'm not going to stand there. I'm going to start moving. If you shape up like this, I'm going to hit you, or I'm going to move. I'm not going to be a standing target. Now, that's what Aikido's taught me.
Sure.
Right? Yep. If I stay there, then I'm going to respond to you. Mm-hmm. But if I start moving, now you have to respond to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But people forget these simple things about Aikido and then say it doesn't work.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
I wouldn't go toe-to-toe with someone. No way, none. No way. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But I've done things I haven't been proud of, working in doors and nightclubs. There's been more than one person. You know, I've pushed someone down the stairs and then dealt with the other person. And if you take Aikido away from the locks and throws and think about Aikido, it's how you move your body, how you use your mind, your body, and spirit. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And if that means picking up a bar stool and hitting someone over the head with it, then do that. Like, that's what Shota Gozo did. But as soon as someone does that, they go, oh, that's not Aikido. Aikido is how I use my body.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's a great way to describe it.
That's one aspect. The other aspect is that Aikido is also how to live your life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, if you had to deal with a drunken relative at a party and you left him with a broken nose, tomorrow he ain't going to be happy. But if you pinned him and just say, chill, relax, and take him out of the party, tomorrow when he sobers up, you'll still be good relatives.
That's true.
You know, so someone once said Aikido is the art of reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take that into your workplace, Tristan, you know, do you want people butting heads? Do you want them working together?
Sure.
If there's a problem, do you want one person to win and the other one lose and forever be enemies, or, you know, work together to get the best possible result? So how many fights you been in, Tristan?
Half dozen, I'd say, or less. Or, you know,
most people haven't even been in that many.
Right.
And the last fight they've been was 20 years ago or something.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we practicing?
Yeah. No, and granted, in that number, I'll also include what isn't in the number, which is a number that more than that that could have turned into fights, but because I was smart about it, I didn't get let it get to that point. That there's a dozen or more, you know, where
hence what I said,
acted out of ego or out of, you know,
I do notice how you use your mind, your body, and your spirit. I've stared people down, right? Inside, I was shit scared, really shit scared, but I've stared them down.
Sure.
That was my training. I didn't want to take them on. I would have lost if I took them on.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to take on a big islander.
Sure.
Let alone three of them, right? Ain't going to happen.
No.
But I stood my ground, and that was it, right?
By the way, when you said it's how to live your life, I will say that I did use Aikido to successfully negotiate a multi-million-dollar lawsuit.
Really?
There wasn't any punches involved, but certainly the loss would have far exceeded getting my face beaten up. But the principles were still absolutely there. You know, use patience when patience is needed. Use assertiveness when assertiveness is needed, and know your opponent.
Yeah, and I'm sure, like what you said before about the coach winning all the time. You in that negotiation, it was give and take, right?
Right, that's right.
It wasn't just this is what I want. It was give and take. And
correct.
We need and that.
It certainly wasn't just apply as much aggression as you possibly can to prevail. That does not work.
No.
Yeah.
And you know, there's another thing about the psychology of violence that's lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
No two people of equal strength, power, aggression will face off with each other. Does not happen.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get two lions going at each other. You get one older lion and a younger one who thinks it's my turn now. I'm better, sure. Right? And one wins because one's better. If they were both equal, they'd back away.
Yeah.
Same thing in all the fights I've seen. There's always, you know, you can always pick the one who's more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
You can always pick the one who's got knows something that the other person doesn't know. It's never equal, never. And yet we want to go toe to toe with someone and see which art is better. It's, you know, for me, it's quite very teenagerish, very childish.
I totally agree, and that's why it frustrates me seeing this art versus that art. Stuff that is always flying around because it's pure entertainment. It's not meant for anything.
I did a demonstration in 2005, and someone told me there's millions of views. Millions, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason there's millions of views was because it was rated Aikido versus Karate. That was the title.
Right. Yeah. Right? That's what gets clicked.
Yeah, and that's what people want. I refuse to buy into that.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, when I looked at starting a podcast or trying to contribute to the Aikido community of just filming technique and throwing it up there, YouTube is largely an entertainment platform. That's what if you really want to build a big channel, you do it either through buffoonery or controversy or something that appeals to, you know, the masses. And I'm more of a fundamentals education. You know, I want to learn. I don't want to just be entertained by some clown or be a clown to entertain people that don't care to be educated, don't care to improve themselves. So that's kind of why I like having these discussions, because it's not clown buffoonery. It's not creating controversy or anything like that. It's about really learning from each other.
Do you know what's absent with us? Money.
Well, there's that too.
No, Look at Shiota Gozo, look at Ueshiba. They all had backing, they all had sponsors, they had money.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore they could do what they wanted.
Sure.
I mean, we have to suffer idiots, we have to suffer fools. Right? Why do we do that? But because it's a professional dojo, we need everyone in there paying their fees. But really, we shouldn't suffer fools.
I agree.
After 50 years, I'm still suffering fools. It's like enough, you know, and it's soul destroying, and it takes away from you teaching a good class when you have to put up with idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I had sponsors I would have special class for Uchideshi. I'd have special class for certain people. And the general public could train in the evenings. That's what the Yoshinkan was. That's what all the old dojos were. Without sponsorship, you cannot have that core of instructors, and you can't have constant classes.
Yeah, that's true. So, as I also look too about, you know, marketing my own dojo and how others are kind of struggling to find students and whatnot, I think that the identity problem comes into it, where they want to throw such a wide net out to get enough students to pay for their school, pay for the rent. Yeah. They sometimes don't have a strong identity of here's a like-minded student that will fit in well with what this dojo is about. And I like the definition you provided earlier about, you know, not just having every warm body you can get in the door, but about having, you know, we're here to develop the character. We're here to develop the person, the people, because there's a lot of people that go to train martial arts that's not their interest.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's exercise or they just want to compete or they want to learn to hurt people, you know, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't have anything to do with that development.
Going back to what you said, Aikido does have a bad name. It does have a bad rap, and I don't know how to combat that. One of the questions I asked the panel was like, you get people coming to do Yoshinkan Aikido, and they said no, they don't ask for that, they don't know what it is. And I said, in the past right. I had a lot of people from other martial arts who knew my name or who knew the name of Yoshinkan Aikido and who came specifically for that. But now, because of the bad rap that it's got, we don't get people from other martial artists coming in.
Right.
So people aren't asking the question, but we think, oh, it doesn't matter. It does matter.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's like that old study of planes that were coming back from bombing Germany.
Right. Yeah.
And looking at the bullet holes, right?
I remember that.
And so we're looking at the wrong side of the question.
Yeah. For those, by the way, who've not heard this story, it's a classic of logic. And that is during World War II, there was, you know, some engineer that decided he wanted to try to improve the survivability of bombers that would go over Germany. And he would study the planes when they came back and made this really robust study about where the bullet holes were in the plane and about what parts needed to be armored. And he, you know, concluded that, well, here's where all the bullet holes are. This is what we need to armor. And the logic fault at play was that only the surviving planes that came back were the ones studied. The bullet holes that went in other parts of the plane meant they never made it back. And so they put the armor in the exact wrong spot for the bullet holes of the surviving planes. And it's a great thing. It's easy to lose sight of what seems obvious, but is not not necessarily obvious.
Yeah. And I asked someone my co-author of this book was a very, very intelligent, that's a shameless plug, by the way.
Yes.
Co-author of the book, his name's Marvin Oka. And I said to him, how do we combat this perception that Aikido is like, you know, he says, you can't. Mm-hmm. And it sounds really simple, but he said, you just have to do the best that you can.
Sure.
And as soon as you try and combat it, you're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you just go out there and do your own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and within your discussion, I wrote this word down because you got brought up about unity. And that is the question that came to my mind is, okay, what is the common ground that Aikidoka can rally to? Because without that, you will have the split, right? And it can't be so specific that some people will say, no, that's not what I want for my Aikido. And one example would be, do you want your Aikido to be capable of defending yourself if you get attacked? And there are a lot of people like, no, I don't care about that. And that's, which is fine. And what occurs to me is that if you picture Aikido as being a self-development tool, you have to acknowledge that that tool can be used for many different things, generating, improving your character, improving your balance, your body, your fitness, even your mind, without ever having a focus on having it be self-defense capable, or you maybe work as a security person or a police officer and you don't want to use it for that. That's fine. But I think where we get the splintering is where somebody says, well, this is what I like for my Aikido, and that this is what it actually is, and nobody else is right about what they like about it. And therefore you get these almost factional rifts between them. But I think the unity is kind of the challenge when it comes to the splintering, whether it's one organization of Aikido versus another, one interpretation of Aikido versus another, even one instructor versus another, one practitioner versus another, where they say, well, you don't do what I do, so there's a barrier between us. I see that as kind of an issue, where not accepting other people for what they want from their art is fine. You know, and there's a lot of people that do say, yeah, that's pretty cool, but it doesn't explain how it gets bad enough where organizations start splintering, or there's open animosity from one to the other. I'm not sure how to solve it.
there's always going to be animosity. There's always going to be, that's human nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have different likes, dislikes, leads to people thinking I'm better than you, I understand it more than you, whatever. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing, right? So when I was training, there were, like, aside from Shiura Gozo, in the main dojo, there were two other teachers, Takeno Sensei and Chida Sensei. Mm-hmm. And you kind of liked one or the other because they were quite different. Mm. One was really smooth and smooth as silk. The other one was sharp as, and their characters were the same, right? Mm. But they were both, could be both really hard. They could both be really gentle, whatever you want, right? So mm-hmm. if the problem arose when you wanted to be like this person or this person, if you wanted to be like him, then everything else everyone else said is wrong.
Sure.
But yeah. If you're happy to learn from him, then what he said would be accepted too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem now is many people look at a teacher and say, I want to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
So everything everyone else is doing is wrong unless it looks like that.
Right.
But if you think,
I've seen the exact same.
Yeah. If you think I want to be the best that I can be, then you can take from different sources, and then there's not that polarization.
Right.
But when you have blinkers on, then there's polarization. And I'll go one better, Tristan.
Mm-hmm.
We are being defined today, be it in martial arts, politics, whatever, right? Not by what we believe, but by what we don't like.
No, that's okay, true.
So ask people what they believe in. They'll tell you what they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
In politics, anything. And you say, no, that's fine. That's fine. That's what you don't like. What do you believe in?
Right.
And then you'll find something that we can unify around.
Sure. But and the same holds true for what do you want? And they'll say, I don't want this or I don't want that. We're like, okay, well, that's fine. But what do you want? What is it?
Exactly.
You want?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. And if we can get over that, boom, I think that you'll find common ground quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
What is it you like in Aikido? I don't like that it's not efficient. I don't like that it's not real, etc. Mm-hmm. But what do you like? And if you come down to it, they'll say movement, the fact that there's really good spirit training with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's prevalent in all Aikido schools, or should be.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think that those common threads are, you make them. And organizations don't get along with other people. People do. It's down to the people. And like even within our conversation today where you said that, you know, when you asked me about what I think of Aikido as, and you said, well, that describes Yoshin, basically Yoshinkan perfectly. Like that to me builds a bridge between what you want from your Aikido, what your Aikido is and what mine is and what I want from it. Like, and I wish we were closer together because I'd love to get on the mat. Like, let's explore this, what it means, you know, from a physical standpoint, as well as from the verbal that we have.
I agree. And when you get on the mat and you start sharing your experiences, you know,
mm-hmm.
you find there's so much commonality.
Absolutely, yeah.
But
you find the commonality when you haven't already pre-created the walls in your own mind that said we don't have things in common, that things you do differently than we do.
Okay, so I'm going to play the devil's advocate now, right? After saying all that, why is unity important?
To me, because it brings clarity. Without unity, if you have a bunch of people that are all doing different things and you want to attract new people, those new people, you don't have a message that makes any sense to them. They don't know what they're getting into. You know, and I would say this describes Aikido. When you ask 10 Aikido practitioners or instructors what it is, they don't have one or two clear answers. They've got probably 15 answers. And so how do you appeal to new people when you can't have a solid answer for what it is you're actually doing or what they might want to participate in?
Here's the thing, though. Most people are enamored or taken up by the teacher, not by what's being taught.
Absolutely true. Yeah. And, one of the things I wanted to bring up, so I'm glad you got into it.
I hear so many people talk and they say, you know, Chris Johnson, who translated Aikido Shugyo and Aikido Jinsei, showed us books. He said, I saw Kimura Sensei and I thought, that's what I want to do. Didn't matter what he was teaching, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so many people, like, you know, will walk on the mats and go, wow, whatever he's doing, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened when people saw the Seagal movies. They're like, yep, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I looking back, that was me. You know, when at the age of 11 or 12, I saw Dragon Sensei and his teachers. I'll go, I want to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the technique is secondary when attracting people.
Right.
But the perception we have in the wider world now with Aikido, it's people aren't coming to the dojo to see us. Yeah.
Right.
And you know, if you come into the dojo and you look at and feel the atmosphere of an Aikido dojo, a good Aikido dojo, it's amazing. There's so much vibrancy. There's so much, so many nice people. I think, but it's the same in lots of martial arts. You just got to find what suits you. And when I walk into a good Aikido dojo, I feel the vibe.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's unless you do it, it's hard to explain, right?
It is very hard to, and that's why I brought up that question of, is martial art personality based? And you pretty much answered that right there. If it's personality based, the way that I, for example, I see it is, I think Morihei Ueshiba was probably the Bruce Lee of his age. He was a celebrity. He impressed people by what he showed them. Now, it was before, you know, the films and the movies and things like that, but we see these trends that come on movie stars that bring a martial art to people, and they go, wow, look at that. You know, they're a celebrity in that sense. Or there's the sport champions who bring their martial art and show that they win championships in sport. People go, wow, they're a celebrity. I wanted to be able to do that. And so, as I see that and I look at, okay, well, who have the Aikido celebrities been in the last 30 years? And really, you can only pick one to me, which is Seagal, because he was what, still 90s. That was within the 30-year gap.
Yeah.
But there have been very little for that. Aikido does not have a presence in the sport martial art world. And I think there's a good reason why not. So you're not going to get a sport celebrity, but then you're going to get movie or TV star would be about your only other chance. And that seems like a very, I don't know, a sad way of trying to generate awareness of what the art is and you know, quality martial art by saying, okay, well, we're going to go and, you know, to me, a movie just is a multi-million dollar commercial, you know, for a martial art. That's really what it is. And you know, martial art demonstrations, when you see one that's not done on a, you know, Hollywood budget, it you can tell it's like it's poor acting. It's not choreographed by professional stuntmen. You know, it can look pretty good, but it won't compete with somebody who's like, I just came back from the John Wick movie, and that's what I want to do. I want to, you know, like you said, that's what I want to do. Of course, if they go to talk to any martial artist or any person skilled with violence, say, okay, you need to bring your expectations down a little bit, because you're not going to be John Wick or James Bond or, you know, Jason Bourne or any of these action star type things, because that's crafted to make them look awesome. But yet it drives the market for martial arts students. And that's just a fact.
where's the logic when they say Aikido doesn't work or martial arts don't work, and then they get enamored by a John Wick movie?
Right.
Where's the logic? That's fantasy, it is. Right? You know, yeah. Anyone who's been in a fight would just like, you know, but I like watching the John Wick movie. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you know? It's great entertainment.
Yeah, I don't go looking for a Kevlar suit, though.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's people don't know what they want.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say Aikido doesn't work, it's rubbish, etc. But then they judge it by John Wick's moves or mm-hmm. 007's moves and think, you know, oh, that was Aikido and that Aikido works. That was sure. A movie. You know, Steven Seagal once said, I don't make martial arts movies. I make action movies with martial arts in it.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And you cannot, it's like judging Einstein by watching Oppenheimer.
Right.
Oppenheimer's, you know, great movie, but it mm-hmm. is a movie. It's a depiction right. of history.
Mm-hmm.
And one small thing can change everything.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, and this is one of the reasons I've liked interviewing so many people that come from the world of professionals that deal with violence, because they will often say, I've had many of them say, it's like, my Aikido never failed me when I needed to do it, when I needed to use it in the field, in a real environment. They said, it won't look like what it looks like in a demonstration. It won't look like what it looks like on a mat, but the principles work. They are, in fact, about the only ones that really fit in that civilian type environment. And to me, that's profound. But what you don't see is highlight movies, because you don't often get film and video footage off of from a real world type scenario or situation. So it's hard to sell that way, because we live in the age of, well, if you don't have a video of it, it's bullshit. You know, it didn't happen.
Have you ever watched the sumo?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You watch it, and one wins, the other one loses, okay? Mm-hmm. But till it's broken down and done in slow motion and they identify the technique, you don't know what happened. You just saw one person throw another. And they have names for the techniques, but it looks different from the bare basic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much subtlety and nuances. We don't pick the technique, so we think, oh, that wasn't a technique, but it was.
Sure.
Same thing, you know, like I've you know, I'm not proud to say this, but I've downed someone just with an open palm strike to the face.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm 64 kilos. Where did that power come from?
Mm-hmm.
That guy was a little bit bigger than me. It just came in spur of the moment, came from the hips, came from the legs. I don't know. Did not come from the hand. I'm not strong enough.
Sure.
Was that Aikido for me? Yes, it was. Years of slapping mm-hmm. the mat, years of, you know, mm-hmm. swinging, turning. It's how you use your body.
Right. And you could also say it's how you use your mind. You had your intent on delivering power.
Yep.
That's the body integration with the mind. And if your mind wasn't there, it wasn't just the body doing it.
I had a student working on the door of a club, and he came in and he said, oh, I grabbed this guy. This guy grabbed me. I took his arm and I did Nikajo or Nikyo. And he says, mm-hmm. as soon as I took his arm, I knew I couldn't do it.
Mm.
So you know what he did? He headbutted the lock and dropped the guy. And that's not using your body. I don't know what is.
Right. Yeah. It's like, of course, I like using the head. So I thought that's a brilliant solution. If it gets the job done, you know, it gets the job done. And I don't know of an instructor that would go teach that, but
no,
if he knew what needed to happen, and
you couldn't teach that. It had to happen the spur of the moment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and that actually comes into another question that I came up with to cover with you about the idea of integrating more live play into training. And I think we've discussed, touched on this in our previous discussions a little bit, but I think that from my last podcast where we talk about the next evolution of martial arts, I think that arts that stick to kata practice and theory only are going to be disappearing, and they're going to give way to people that want to actually be able to apply their martial art under those unpredictable conditions and to be able to do some live play. I think this is one of the reasons that Brazilian jiu-jitsu gyms are popular, because they do offer that live play aspect to them. Mm-hmm. Some do it a little too much and don't do enough technique from what I've been hearing, but I think that there does need to be that ingredient. And I think I remember talking about this of last time when we spoke about ending a class with a good portion of time where students can play and work on adapting their art to an unscripted or a wide open type of a environment.
So I agree, but I run a very traditional class, very strict dojo. Mm-hmm. And for me, that play time is after class.
Okay.
Obviously, it has to be monitored, etc., because correct. For me, the class time is structured and it's you're on my clock.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, you stay and I'll help you. You want to do something, you want to ask me any question you want. If I can help you, I will. You want to try playing, I will monitor it.
Sure.
The dojo is a great place to be made to feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a safe environment to push the envelope. Mm-hmm. And as teachers, we have to keep that safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
You could train for years and then you have that play and someone gets hurt. Because
sure.
egos start to get involved.
Mm. Okay.
And when I do that play, right, or used to, if you had a balance break on me, I'd go over.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to stand there and let you wreck my wrist just for me to prove you're wrong. Sure. I wasn't going to do that. So, and also, I would do it with people who would like, if they threw me, they wouldn't fall on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need people of a certain level to be able to do that.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. And people need to know how to give and take, and you have mm-hmm. to put the ego aside. It's sure. not about winning and losing. It's about exercising, you know, that like you said, that negotiations with that multi-million-dollar deal mm-hmm. wasn't about winning. It's about finding an outcome, right?
Right.
And the play is about both people learning and surviving, mm-hmm. not about one person winning.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's one aspect. The other mm-hmm. aspect, and this is going back to confidence, okay? Mm-hmm. I used to teach in a couple of Kyokushin dojos. And so when they had tournaments, I'd go do demonstrations. And some of the guys afterwards would ask me, what's it like doing security at nightclubs? And I would tell, you know, I'd shrug my shoulders and they'd say, what sort of things you have to deal with? And I'd tell them and they'd say, oh, I couldn't do that. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking, you just went toe to toe with someone. I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So it's what you're used to. How do you simulate the street violence where if you're mm-hmm. down on the ground, no one throws in the towel.
Right.
No one's going to stop you. How do you simulate not knowing whether the person's going to pull out a syringe or a knife? How do you mm-hmm. simulate not knowing if there's more than one person that you're dealing with?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't. And so you can do all the play you want, but as soon as you go out there, your confidence is.
Sure. Well, and I've taken that as kind of a challenge. In fact, I was working just this week integrating a series of drills and practice where I add in I'm trying to break the formula of, okay, here's how the technique starts, which is with an attack. You respond, you do your waza, you go to a pin, and you're totally locked into just that one person. And I've started breaking this into kind of different stages of getting to a initial position. You're still watching, you got your hands on your attacker, you get him down, you're looking around. And included with that is, and I've started playing with this recently, of getting your attacker down on all fours, which, and then your weight is on him. You're kind of like a wrestler, you're putting weight on their back or on yep. their shoulders so they have a hard time maneuvering. They can get up from there, but it's not easy to do. And then you can look around or get them to a point where they're on the floor because they might fall. They might not go to the floor, but you check the belt for a weapon. But you're looking around, and I'll actually, as students are doing this, I'll walk by and I'll say, if I have my hand up, that means I'm a threat, and you're not going to stay down there with the person. You're going to get back and up and out. So it builds the awareness of doing technique while they're watching their environment more. So while it's not a full-on scenario, real-world scenario, it starts giving them the ingredients of not getting hyper-focused like they would in a kata, where they're just worried about their technical ability with their uke and then getting down. So it's almost like it's adding that full zanshin all the way through to your whole environment. And I'm playing with that, and I'm enjoying how it's going so far. And I think there's a lot of ways to expand into it further, and I want to explore that further. But to me, that's where whether it's sport fighters or even with dojo training that focuses too much on katas or paired katas can lose sight of those things. And I think that's what everybody that I've interviewed and talked about over the years of. From a real world standpoint, says that's the stuff that's important of surviving the real world. And
the mindset.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you get around the mindset? So last year in September, I just had an operation on my knee in August. And in mm-hmm. September, I went to Toronto and I went to Guayaquil in Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And in Guayaquil, we taught two lots of police units mm-hmm. and one army unit. The first police unit we taught, I was in a teaching mode. Mm-hmm. And this one person said, can I grab you? And he grabbed me, and I was trying to teach him, and he went Viking on me. Right? And I end up on the ground with him. I re-wrecked my knee after that operation, right?
Oh.
And I'm thinking, that would never have happened in the old days, because in the old days I was used to teaching security, bouncers, mm-hmm. etc. And mm-hmm. I was in the mode where I would expect that.
Okay.
This time, my fault. I wasn't expecting him to go hard on me. So sure. I end up giving him a cut nose. But why? Wrecked my knee? What's the point? So sure. It's that mindset too, that mm-hmm. and how you approach things. You said earlier, you avoided situations because you had mm-hmm. the right mindset. You mm-hmm. stopped it before it started. I did not have the correct level of aggression to deal with that.
Mm. Okay.
So now tell me, if you go into a situation, right, you're going with this much aggression, it's really hard to raise it up. Mm-hmm. If you go with this much aggression, it's easier to bring it down.
Sure.
How many people who do Aikido want to approach a situation with that much aggression?
That's true. And sometimes that level of aggression can even get you into some deep trouble.
That's it.
And but, there was a story that I shared on my Spirit Aikido Online program, mostly because it was a little sensitive, but I can kind of summarize it here. And I had a student that came to me years ago, and he had trained in a previous dojo here in the Twin Cities. And this is world-class instructor, and he was one of the seniors in the group. So the seniors got together and they said, all right, we want to train for more realism, right? And they came up with this idea about how they're not going to allow, low or mid or intermediate students in. This is for seniors only. And when they do it, they're going to, the attackers, the ukes, or what they would, it wasn't Aikido, it was another art, but their ukes were going to get serious. They were going to start thinking, I want to hurt this other person, and train under as close to simulated conditions as you can get, or as close to real conditions as you could get, in terms of aggression, attitude, mindset, which totally sounds valid. Like, okay, why wouldn't you? If you were really looking to train for realism, why not do that? And what they found was, and I like using the term mirroring for this, what they found is when you as Nage are the one that was supposed to protect yourself, you would start actually mirroring the attitude and mindset of your attacker. So you would get into that serious, I'm going to hurt you kind of mode. And they would train this way, and they did indeed get better. But it was like a switch you turned on, kind of like we described. If you go into a situation at this level of intensity and you need that level, that was the switch. And because they had trained it hour after hour after hour, they could drop on a dime and switch into that killer beast mode. And effectively, I mean, that's what you do when you train it, that you get better at it. Well, a number of these students, including the gentleman told me this story, went and got jobs in security, and they were working nightclubs. They were working, you know, in some rather seedy areas. And what it led to, what he told me was, it led to him doing some reprehensible, almost what he thought was monstrous things. And it led to him getting PTSD, because he would automatically drop into that mindset and do things that were beyond appropriate. And I still remember when he called me the day that 10 years had passed, which was the statute of limitations from when he ended that job, being relieved that he never wound up getting into any legal trouble because of things that he had done. But he still remembers, because he has a mental video of it, of, you know, how bad that was. And he took a lot of healing to try to get past it. And so I took that as a lesson as an instructor of, like, okay, what mindset are you training for when you train to deal with violence? And the dangers of getting into that militaristic, 100%. I know combatives nowadays are very popular in terms of unleashing, 100% firepower on somebody as quickly as possible to protect yourself. But I think of that story when I see some of this stuff from a combative standpoint, which would be great on a military battlefield, but I think may not be the best fit for a civilian to be using to protect themselves.
Listen, you get a police officer gets a call out, okay? So he's a rookie, maybe a month out of the academy. Mm-hmm. He gets a call out for a robbery or robbery in progress, enters the house with his gun drawn, and in his mind, he's saying, I hope no one's here. I hope no one's here. I hope no one's here. Same situation. It's the SWAT, and they go, where's the fucker? Where's the prick? Mm-hmm. Who's got better survivability?
Yeah. No, but, that's true.
But the reason armies aren't on constant top alert is because that plays with your mind. Imagine sleeping with your rifle, sleeping dressed, moments notice. That's why you've got to go on alert and then drop, on alert, drop. Mm-hmm. Most people can't do that.
That's true.
Like you said, it's that switch you got to flick. And that switch is not flicked when you start work in the nightclub. You flick that switch when you feel you need to. Then you switch it off. On, off, on, off.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even the Romans knew, because they had trouble with their centurions coming back to society because they had trained them to be so aggressive and so combative that they weren't in a good mindset to come back to society, and they had trouble with it. And from what I remember reading about history, is that's a big reason that Hadrian's Wall was built, was to keep a legion busy doing something so they weren't terrorizing the natives and the townspeople. Like, we need a project, and they would go and build this thing as an outlet for that aggressive energy. So,
and an army that doesn't fight turns in on itself.
That's true. That's absolutely right. And so as a nurturer of people, of character of my students, of making sure that I try to help them build the, if you need the switch, it's there and you can turn it, but you want to live in a state where you're calm enough, because then you can think, then you can solve your problem with your brain, not just, go berserk.
The aftermath. So one of the big problems when I've done security or taught people to do security is the debrief after, when it's like, I should have done this, I could have done that, I should have done this, and you feel bad for either having done too much or too little. You have to be able to accept within yourself that what I did at that point in time was okay.
Sure.
Same situation, same person, tomorrow I react differently, that's okay too. But if you cannot accept your actions and the consequences of your actions, then don't get into any situations.
That's true. And this brings me to
yourself. You cannot live with yourself.
Yeah. What I think is a very good description of Aikido, just as a martial art, if you had to have like a single one sentence answer, it would be an appropriate response to a confrontation, appropriate use of the result, or appropriate use of technique, or whatever you'd want to call it. because, you know, I know that's not sexy, and people who say, well, I want to be John Wick, or I want to be one of these combatives guys that just starts absolutely annihilating people and taking their teeth out. And, you know, what do you say to that? Like, okay, well, that's may not be appropriate. And I see the same thing here in America with some people that are within the firearm culture. You know, they don't do any type of training. They're not good with their hands, but they like having a pistol on their hip because they think, well, this is going to solve my problem. I just have to buy a really nice gun and practice with it once in a while, and I can shoot somebody, and then my self-defense problem is solved. And while that might solve a problem, you know, if the issue is that 95% of violent encounters do not warrant the use of lethal force, now what are you going to do? If that's the only answer you've got, and the situation doesn't warrant the use of lethal force, now are you going to shoot somebody, and now you're in trouble? And that's the way why I like that appropriate use of force.
I spoke to a vet. He'd done 3 tours in Afghanistan and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to mention names, but he said that it is totally, totally unnatural for one human being to kill another.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
And he says it does things to you. Mm-hmm. It does things to you. It will screw you up. It will screw up your brain.
Yep. Well, I remember reading, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman's book. He had one on it was called On Killing, and the other one was On Combat, yeah. And the psychological effect and damage of harming other human beings. That is, if you weren't a psychotic. You know, there are a few people out there that are broken mentally that don't mind doing it because of that. But you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Tristan, I'm going to hijack your conversation here.
Sure.
When we were corresponding, you said you were going to ask me something about something I said in the interviews about throwing someone and them laughing.
Yes, I remember it was near the end. And this actually plays into the mindset thing, so I think this is topic will go on. But I think, if I remember right, you said something about it was you saw at a seminar where you had a brown belt and a senior Udansha had thrown him, and the brown belt got thrown and then kind of laughed, and he said, that's great. And that you didn't like that part about it. And I wanted you to elaborate on kind of what your perspective was on why and
I mean, okay, so I'm not sure that story, but it's happened to me too. I've thrown people mm-hmm. who'd like, you know, Shodan, Nidan, Sandan. And they've laid on the floor and said, wow, that was great. That was fantastic, and mm-hmm. laughed. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where's the Zanshin?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, Zanshin, is that, if you do a sword art, is the Zanshin just on the part of the Shidachi, or do you Chidachi as well?
Mm.
Okay. It's on good both. Question. Right?
Okay.
So the one question is, you get thrown, you jump up to your feet, and you maintain eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's Zanshin. Okay. Not laying on the floor laughing and saying, that's wonderful, that's fantastic.
That's a good point.
Wonderful. Okay. Yeah. One thing. Second, in the Yoshinkan that I knew, if you were thrown, your job was to regain your feet really quick, nothing else.
Nice. Okay.
Right? So mm-hmm. if you, and that was like, you know, it's 7 times down, 8 times up type thing, right? You
sure.
just go boom and you're up, boom and you're up. You didn't worry mm-hmm. about if your head just got caved in or something. Your job was to stand up and look at the step and see what's going to happen next.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Yeah.
Next, if someone who's a 6 dan, okay, throws someone who's a knee dan, where does that critique come from? Who gives a stuff what the brown belt or the Nidan thinks of what a 6 dance technique is? Sure. Who solicited that?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's happening now. People mm-hmm. say, oh, that's great. Like the 6 dance could be looking at something else and you're giving him critique.
Mm.
You know, okay. But this is where the traditional, call me anal, call me pedantic, whatever. This is where it's losing its mindset.
Mm.
I remember, you know, training with Draeger Sensei, You know, I had a Joe, he had a sword, bang, back to that. You know, I've seen him send people off because they looked out the window.
Hmm.
Okay. That's the kind of focus that you had to have.
Sure.
You looked out the window once, he says, go home. Don't come back. Hmm. Come back tomorrow. Hmm. You're not here today. Right?
Sure.
Now, but it goes more than that, right? If a teacher says to you, how did that feel? They want to see if you felt what they want you to feel.
Hmm.
They're not looking for a critique.
Okay.
Unless it's the teacher looking for his ego to be stroked.
Hmm.
Right? Now, if you threw someone who's had... how long have you been doing Aikido for?
I started in 2004, so 19 years now.
19 years. If you threw someone who'd been doing it for 2 years mm-hmm. and they gave you a critique on your technique, what would that even mean?
Mm. Well, why are we
putting up for it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I get where you're coming from, but I would also say that even a fool speaks the truth once in a while. So it's worth at least considering what they have to say. And it would be ego for me to, I think my ego would be getting in the way of saying, well, they can't know anything, so I'm going to just blow them off completely. So I tend to be a little bit more absorbent when it comes to, you know, because there are some very talented people out there and somebody that had only been doing Aikido maybe 2 years, maybe he's got 25 years in another martial art. I haven't, yep. Maybe I don't know that. And so I like considering a lot of input and after grinding through it, I can dismiss it or whatnot, but you know,
but that's when you ask someone, how did mm-hmm. that feel?
Sure.
And they give you a response. It's not like in traditional kata, there's nothing unsolicited. Like, you know, there's action, reaction, action, reaction, action, reaction. There's no stop. Let's have a chat, fix your gi, fix your hair. Bang.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's action, reaction. And that's part of the Zanshin, part of doing what is necessary, not doing what is unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's got a role. By all means, come have a beer afterwards mm-hmm. and chat about it, but on the mat.
Sure.
But that's me. That's me just being anal and old.
Yeah.
But for me, it's where the social structure starts to fall apart. You know, I would never give my teacher an unsolicited opinion. If they asked me, I would give my opinion. I would never argue it because it's not my thing. Yeah, Inoue Sensei once said to me, 3-6 dans can't tell an S dan what is right and wrong. Maybe true, maybe not true, I don't know, but he had a point.
Sure.
Smart S dan would listen to the opinion of the 3-6 dans.
Right. I agree.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
At the right time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Going back to a bigger thing, right? In the dojo. So we have a laugh, we have a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if I make a joke on the mat, you watch the next two instructors under me, they will not smile, they will not laugh. My teacher makes a joke, I don't smile, I don't laugh. Can you imagine a sergeant major laughing when a captain makes a joke?
Oh, yeah. That's true.
That's when
I've not been in the military, but I can appreciate the point.
But that's when the social structure, everything breaks down.
Okay.
You know, and it could be funny in that, but it's for him to make the joke or her to make the joke, for me to maintain the discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Have a laugh, have a joke. Everyone else can laugh. I ain't laughing.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's the structure of the dojo, and everyone has their role. Everyone has their place.
Sure. The story about the eighth dan and the sixth dans, or the analogy, kind of brought to mind, and I think this was Malcolm Gladwell's book. What was it? Outliers, where he talked about the experience on Korean Airlines when they had plane crashes, airliners, And after investigating, they found that the captain was usually made an error of some kind, but none of the people below him or the other crew members would ever tell him, no, we're not at the altitude you think we are, because of that rigid code. And so Korean Airlines had to go back and retrain its people to get out of the thinking of that typical kind of the Eastern Oriental, you know, rigid authority. You never mention that a superior may be incorrect. They had to retrain that, and in doing so became one of the safest airlines in the world, but had to turn around a horrible safety record because of that culture part. And this actually comes into a question that you guys had in your podcast, or your discussion was, is the connection to Japan and the Japanese culture an important factor of where Yoshinkan Aikido is going, or where your Aikido is going? And I think that there has been a strong Japanese culture influence to Aikido, and it makes total sense. Is there a point where it does serve, and is there a point where it does not serve how things go? You know what I mean?
Okay, so I'm going to give you the long-winded answer, right?
Okay.
I'm an ace dan. Robert Mustard's an ace dan. Jacques Pai is an ace dan. David Rubin's a seventh dan. Those are the people in the third part of the interview, right? Now, we wanted the opinions of the sixth dans. We wanted the opinions of the seventh dans. They didn't volunteer. We solicited it. I solicited it. And that's the mark of who you are.
Totally agree.
And I think, you know, I've reminded or corrected my teachers before, but very, very subtly.
Right.
Very subtly. Never in public, never, you know, just very subtly. Like I've had an older teacher do a seminar, and he finished before time. And, you know, we had another hour to go, and I said, okay, when he bowed out, and I said, okay, we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in 10 minutes. And he thought the class had finished, but, you know, rather than say, oh, sensei, the class isn't finished yet, I was like, okay, let's do it subtly. Yeah. And he accepted that. Okay. The Japan thing, right? I've been doing Aikido for 50 something years, right? What should direct my Aikido? Japan, the technique, or my principles? I'm in a situation now where my principles direct my actions. When I was younger, the actions formed my principles. Right. That's the teaching. The teaching, the technique, the discipline made me who I am. Now who I am directs what I want. And so the Japan thing, yes, there are good people in Japan who I want to maintain a connection with. Is it imperative? No, is it what I want? Yes. And we have a good relationship with Japanese teachers. The head of my organization is Inoue Sensei's wife. I want that connection. And I'm not going to say I want it on my terms. I'm willing to give and take.
Sure.
But I want that connection, and I will bend over to keep that connection. Will I change 100% or succumb to every whim that they say? No. Because I decide my Aikido. I've earned that right. I've earned that. And I don't say that egotistically. I just say it factually. And after many years of doing Aikido, why should someone else tell me what Aikido is for me?
Sure.
Why should someone else say, this is what you should do, this is how it should look? No. My teachers taught me Aikido, but they never told me what to do with it.
Sure.
And I think I had a good and lucky upbringing. I had great teachers. And so I now decide what I want to do with my Aikido. I decide the relationships I want to have. And if things are a bit toxic, then I say, thank you very much. You know, I'll see you next time.
Sure.
I don't need to suffer fools anymore in that situation. Yeah. On the mats, yeah, unfortunately. So I want the Japanese connection. I think you can do Aikido in many good places now. You can train Aikido anywhere in the world that has good dojos. But there's only one place where you can get the Japanese experience.
Sure.
Yeah. Don't mistake the two, though, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You can train hard in Japan. You can learn some really good Aikido in Japan and have the Japanese experience. And you can train hard outside and have the Australian experience, the Canadian experience, the American experience. It's all different.
Mm-hmm.
Is it integral to your Aikido? I don't think so. But if it's what you want, then you seek it out and you make it happen.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and as you were describing it too, it seems like there is a social aspect. You get a group of people together that are doing anything, and there's going to be, you know, politics. There's going to be the social interaction part. And it kind of reminds me, actually, my grandfather, who was not a social person at all, but he worked with everything. He could fix just about anything. He would craft with glass and with wood. And whenever I saw him work, I realized that what he was doing is he was letting the material that he was working with show him how it went. What he thought did not matter. And his personality reflected that. But if he was working with doing woodworking or doing with metalworking or anything like that, there's either it works or it doesn't. And it was very clear to him that way. And I almost look at my martial art that way, partially because as a competitor back when I was doing it, either what my technique worked or it did not. It succeeded or it failed. It didn't matter what other people thought of it or what I thought of it even, you know. And now getting about, okay, well, whose opinion is correct, it's a good place to kind of start, and you maybe be able to sort some things out there. But the performance actually will determine whether something succeeds or not. And to me, I like that reality aspect. Not that I'm disguising, I love your description of it, but within it, I can also see the measure by which technique or the art itself, made up of techniques, mindset, application, all of that stuff, is either it functions or it does not. And we can be objective about, all right, well, maybe it works partially well, but it could be better. Let's make it better by the objective standards, not on the personalities of the celebrities or the social knit part. I think the social knit part surrounds that objective truth at the center. That makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, like, again, you are aiming for your vision of what Aikido is.
Mm-hmm. At least not for me.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not for me to say it's right or wrong. It's for me to add to it if I can.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you add to mine if you can. Mm-hmm. And we can become better people. Maybe that's that unifying factor. The
Absolutely.
Fact that we can help each other, yeah, not all head down the same road, but help each other go our own ways.
Correct. And I know we're wrapping up here at about 90 minutes, but just to say that regardless of styles, I know that you have things that I would love to steal from you in terms of ability, knowledge, insights, you know. And that's why we're having this. To me, this discussion builds a bridge. Regardless of what organization we're in or not, or independent or not, to me, that's what the blending part, that I is. And I think one of the senseis talked about how contemporary Aikido tends to be missing the I, that harmony, the blending part. And to me, I feel that when you and I have our discussions, or any of the discussions I have on the podcast, is we're finding the common ground that we would get together on.
Yeah, and I think that society in general today, again, that polarization, because we're thinking about what we don't like rather than what we believe in.
Mm-hmm. Or what we disagree on versus what we agree on. I like what we might disagree on, because you might share an insight that makes me change my mind about a falsehood that I might be embracing that I shouldn't. And so I like hearing those.
Everyone says, you know, like, don't look at what's different, look at what's the same in different teachers, mm-hmm. and that's what you should follow. I think to some extent that's true. Mm-hmm. What's the same is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. What's different is makes us who we are as individuals.
That's right.
And they're both to be embraced. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should just look at what's different and throw it out. What's different is makes us who we are as individuals.
Absolutely.
And Robert Mustard and I, we've been teaching together for almost 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And it's really, we have good interactions. We don't mm-hmm. agree on everything. Some things mm-hmm. we vehemently disagree on, like who's better looking and stuff. there's things like conceptual things that we disagree on, but what we agree on is bigger than what we disagree. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you get many eighth dance teaching together for as long as we have.
Sure.
And I think it's a good reflection of the I in Aikido.
Yes.
We both got egos. We both believe in different things, but we come together and we get along.
Yep. That's true. You know, to me, that what we have in common would make me want to get on the mat with you and go a long way to do it. Once we get there, I'd like to see what you do differently than I do, because that's where I think the iron sharpens the iron principle comes into play. You know, rather than us getting together, I think you guys talked about this, a Kumbaya festival of getting together. But it's like, but the glue, the stuff that makes us want to get together in person, that's the I part, and that needs to be there.
And what we do the same solidifies mm-hmm. what we, the art, right?
Absolutely.
What we do different adds to improving.
That's
and
true.
Understanding. You mm-hmm. don't have to do what I do, but once you start to understand things, you think, all right, I can change that. I can do it this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So. Well, I love this discussion. It certainly just did not disappoint. I was very much looking forward to it. Would you like to give it your book plug one more time before we wrap up?
Okay. All right, people. This is Budo, the Art of Being. It's my words written by Marvin Oka. I just spouted. He took out all the swearing and he dressed it up and he made me look better than what I am. So this book is Marvin's Making My Dream Come True. So think about it and read. There's synopses out there. If you don't like it, that's fine too.
I look forward to it. I really want to get into that because I've loved our discussions and I look forward to more of them. So also plug for his series. I believe the second episode of three of them will be coming out here in the next few days. And then there's a third episode that will be coming. Definitely check that out. Give the name on that people can look up on YouTube.
Just hashtag keep the flame alive. And I think it's what now, where to next for the Yoshi.
Sure. And because the first episode's already dropped, I will put a link to that in the show notes for this
Thank episode. Thank you so much. Thank you, Tristan.
Great. Thank you, Sensei. It's been a great discussion. I really appreciate the time and look forward to it again.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Stay tuned for more episodes. I've got some great stuff on the way very soon. In the meantime, enjoy your training.